Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL New Hampshire Talk Radio. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. This week, we continue with our series focused on candidates for Congress in New Hampshire's 1st and 2nd districts. Over the next several weeks, you will hear from both Republican and Democratic candidates. In one-on-one interviews, each will have an opportunity to share their background, experience, and policy priorities. They will also answer questions related to the nation's fiscal challenges and how, as members of Congress, they might work to resolve them. Today, you will hear from two candidates in the 1st Congressional District race, Maura Sullivan and Terrence O'Rourke. But before we dive into today's candidate discussions, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. In an attempt to continue finding ways to speed up the appropriations process, the Senate will be supplementing a House appropriations bill package with its own, as well as adding two more bills to the bundle. The Senate's now four-bill appropriations package would have a $154 billion price tag. But the move to speed up the process for the fiscal year 2019 appropriations bills comes with a significant risk. Doubling the number of bills in the package increases the chance of funding disparities and policy disagreements that could derail final compromise between the House and Senate. A new push for an infrastructure plan will come to the House this week. However, its own sponsor does not expect the measure to succeed, but hopes it will be the beginning of a serious discussion on how to finance a major infrastructure spending initiative. A bill was introduced last week that would index the capital gains tax to inflation, which would result in lower taxes on capital gains. It is not clear if the bill will be attached to the second round of tax cuts that are currently being discussed by the House GOP. Details are expected to begin emerging on a Tax Cut 2.0 plan this week. The Trump administration's plan to reorganize the government got a tough reception last week in a key Senate committee. The White House unveiled a sweeping plan to restructure the federal government in an attempt, it says, to make government more efficient and less costly. The plan stopped short of estimating any projected cost savings, however. Some members of the Senate felt too little information had been provided, while others viewed the hearing as the very beginning of the process. Even the administration described many of the proposals as works in progress. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. Up next, I will be joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate, Maura Sullivan. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate Maura Sullivan. Maura is a retired Marine Corps captain and served in Iraq. She and her husband live in Portsmouth. Maura earned her two master's degrees from Harvard and served during the Obama administration on the American Battle Monuments Commission and later as assistant secretary at the Veterans Affairs Department. She is running as a Democrat to represent the 1st Congressional District of New Hampshire. Thanks for joining the show, Maura.
Thanks, Chase. Really appreciate the opportunity to be on. It's great to be here.
Well, we're certainly happy to have you on Facing the Future. And before we jump into any necessarily fiscal policy-oriented questions, I guess it would be great to hear a little bit about why you're running to represent New Hampshire in Congress and maybe what some of your policy priorities are.
Sure, absolutely. You know, well, look, Chase, I've committed my life to serving our country. And, I come from a family of public servants committed to service. And I've been serving the country for most of my adult life. I served, in the Marines, fought in the Iraq War, was stationed in Japan and in Korea. And then, as you mentioned, I served for a little more than 6 years in the Obama administration. I was appointed by President Obama to serve on the leadership team of the VA, served as a senior leader at the Pentagon. And, looking at this very critical moment in our country, and I've never seen anything like it, where the fundamental principles about what make us America are at stake, and our very democracy is under attack. And you know, what I hear from people all around our state is that people are looking for a new type of leadership in this critical time that is going to go to Washington and put the country first and put people ahead of politics and work together and find common ground and get things done on behalf of the people that elected them. And that's why I'm running, and that's what I'm focused on.
So in the effort to, you know, serve New Hampshire, to continue your public service, to serve people over politics, do you have a set of policy priorities that are really driving you in this particular campaign?
I do. And, you know, one of the most important, you know, lessons I learned about leadership that I, you know, I learned in the Marines, and that was to lead by listening. So that is how I've approached my campaign, has been getting out all around our district, you know, for the past, you know, 8-9 months and listening to what, you know, is on the minds of the people in New Hampshire. And that has informed my priorities. What are the most urgent needs of our state? What I'm hearing from people is that, you know, they want a different type of leadership that's going to, you know, rise to the occasion at this critical time in our country and fight to put, you know, people first and put the country first. What I'm hearing from people is that, you know, their health care is too expensive, that people are worried about being able to afford health care. I'm hearing from people that they're worried, you know, the opioid epidemic is devastating our state. And then I'm hearing from children, from teachers, from young moms, from grandparents, I mean, people all around our state, that they're worried about sending our kids to school because of gun violence. So those are the first things that I'd be focused on as our member of Congress.
Let's kick off there with your mention of leadership. And it's no secret that it's a pretty divided Congress, maybe even a divided nation at the moment. So as you're working on things to address the opioid crisis in New Hampshire or push for an improvement in the healthcare system, how will you work with other members of your party, other parties in general? How do you bring that bipartisan consensus together?
You know, that experience of working together, finding common ground, you know, really comes from my time serving in the Marines. You know, I'm very proud to have the endorsement and support of a fellow Iraq War veteran and Marine, Congressman Seth Moulton, you know, who is supporting veterans all around the country who are running for Congress right now. I think it's this critical time in our country. And I believe that veterans in Congress are going to lead a lot of the change that we need to see in this country and that we need for our state. Because I'll tell you, Chase, you know, when I served in the Marines, no one ever asked what political party, you know, people were a part of. I mean, people barely even asked, frankly, where you were from. We had a mission, and that mission was supporting and defending the Constitution and figuring out really, really tough problems and working together to accomplish the mission and take care of our Marines and bring them home to their families. So I'm really encouraged to see the number of veterans that are running, you know, throughout our country, because together in Congress, we're going to work together to find common ground and get things done.
I go around the state and the region, and I hear from a lot of everyday Americans on the need for bipartisan efforts on key issues. And one of those key issues is one you've already mentioned, and that's health care. It's no secret that our health care system is very expensive. It's about a fifth of our total economy. We spend over $1 trillion on programs like Medicare and Medicaid. So from your perspective, you're in Congress day one. You're looking to tackle health care challenges. Are you looking to improve the current system? Are you pushing for maybe a universal healthcare system? What would be your approach, and what's the best way to pay for it?
Absolutely. So, you know, I have a lot of experience on this topic. You know, I was appointed by President Obama to serve as an assistant secretary at the VA, which is, as you know, the largest integrated healthcare system in the United States. So I have seen firsthand the, you know, challenges of cost and access to care. Look, my ultimate North Star is making sure that every Granite Stater and every person in this country, frankly, has access to quality, affordable health care, period. And that is, you know, that's a fundamental promise of our country. But to be very, very clear, you know, that is under attack right now. You know, and we're a long way from that right now. We have currently a president, we have a Congress that is trying to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. You know, the Affordable Care Act was not perfect legislation. Most legislation is not. But it got a couple critical things done that we had to get done. It got people covered with pre-existing conditions, and we had to get that done. So first and foremost, we need to protect what we have, and we've got to protect coverage for people, including children with pre-existing conditions. And I think trying to take that away is immoral, and I'll fight that with every bone in my body. But then there are a couple of key steps that I think we need to be focused on, initial steps that we can take, regardless of what the makeup of the Congress looks like, to to ensure we get closer to a place where, again, every Granite Stater has affordable access to health care, because that's just what's at risk right now. First and foremost, we need a public option. People need to be able to buy into Medicare that don't have a good private option. And if you take a look at it, you know, the Congressional Budget Office actually has indicated that this will save taxpayers money over the course of 10 years, save more than $150 billion over the course of 10 years. So that is an initial step that we can take toward getting people affordable access to care. Second, Medicare needs to have the ability to negotiate for prescription drug prices. When I worked at the VA under President Obama, you know, the Veterans Health Administration, the VA could negotiate for prescription drug prices. I talk to people all around our state, particularly our seniors, that have sticker shock when they go to pick up their prescription because the prices are too high. So those are two initial things that we've got to get done. And then, you know, finally, we've got to have better mental health care coverage, you know, particularly in the more rural areas of our state. I mean, people aren't getting the mental health care that they need. We've got to make sure that mental health care is on par with physical care, and we've got a long way to go on that. So those are the initial steps that I'd be focused on day one, because it is one of the biggest issues I hear, and I hear it from almost everybody I talk to on our campaign throughout our state.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with New Hampshire congressional candidate Maura Sullivan. We're discussing her policy priorities as well as her take on some of the nation's fiscal challenges. We touched on health care a little bit. You mentioned programs like Medicare. We're seeing this sort of paradigm shift within the federal budget where mandatory spending, programs like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security are taking up a larger piece of the pie, in part because of how demographics are shifting within our country. So let's continue with Medicare for a second. Are there any changes you think need to occur within that system to help make it more sustainable long term? I know you mentioned going the route of a public option in healthcare in general and making some new things available, but the Medicare trustees have indicated the trust fund is on its way to insolvency. So what would be your approach if you think it's necessary to make adjustments there?
You know, listen, I think just first, what we should be talking about, and I'll tell you, I hear this from, you know, probably not surprisingly from people all around our state, you know, Democrats, undeclared voters, and even Republicans, is that, you know, we just had a tax bill that added, you know, more than $1 trillion to the deficit. And that is, you know, both, you know, irresponsible and frankly, just unnecessary. So I think that, you know, that's where we need to start, you know, instead of challenging entitlement spending. And look, we are, you know, as you know, Chase, we are an aging state. New Hampshire is one of the most aging populations of a state in the entire country. I mean, so if you look at the trends and the demographics of where we are going to be in 2030, we need to protect our seniors. We need to protect their well-being, and we need to protect their health care. And I will fiercely fight to protect our seniors and making sure that they have, you know, that they have what they need, because it's going to be a serious challenge for our state. And there's a number of issues that we're going to have to address to make sure our seniors have the resources they need.
So, Maura, let's switch gears to another mandatory spending program, Social Security. It's very much tied to demographics, both in our state and in our country. Another program on the federal spending side that the trustees have said is walking its way quickly toward insolvency. And it might even be at a point where maybe it'll look different for future generations. Do you think there is reform in Social Security? If so, what would it be?
I mean, look, Social Security is something that people have paid into, and it is part of the promise of our country. And we need to make sure that we protect it, and we need to make sure we protect it, you know, on behalf of our seniors in New Hampshire that, you know, have, again, have paid into it in their entire working lives. That is, you know, again, part of the fundamental promise of our country. And we have a very aging population in New Hampshire, and I'm always going to fight fiercely to protect our seniors.
So do you think there are any reforms that are needed? Maybe not in a way that impacts current retirees, but those that might be 20, 30 years out to help the program stay sustainable long term?
I mean, look, we're going to have to make some tough choices as a country, and we're going to have to work, as you mentioned earlier, on a bipartisan basis to, you know, make sure we are doing what is in the best interest of our national security and our economic security. And members of Congress, you know, the job is to work across the aisle to do that. And that's what I'm going to be focused on. But to be clear, I'm always going to fight fiercely for our seniors. We are an aging state. I mean, that is. So core to, you know, the people of our state and the people that I'll be representing, and that's what I'm going to be focused on.
And Maura, you mentioned a couple things along the way, like the recent tax code overhaul and the need for economic security. So what does tax reform look like to you? You've already indicated you think changes need to be made there. So if you were to put forth a bill or work with your colleagues on changes, what changes would you make in the tax code?
Yeah, I mean, I just, again, first and foremost, I think that, we can all agree that increasing the deficit, again, was just both irresponsible and just frankly unnecessary. So that, I mean, that's where we have to start, right? We just need to make responsible choices. And then look, we need a tax plan that benefits working families. And I'm going to be focused on a tax plan that benefits the working families in New Hampshire and that benefits small businesses. We are a small business state. We need to do, we need to have a tax code that incentivizes small businesses, that encourages small business growth, encourages people to come to New Hampshire, start a company, grow a company, because that creates jobs and ultimately, fuels our economy. And that's really the backbone of our economy. And that's what I'd be focused on.
And Maura, let's also look at a topic that might be pretty close to home for you with your experience in the military, and that's discretionary spending in the federal budget. And that's what Congress has control over on an annual basis in the appropriations process. It's about a third of the budget right now and actually diminishing. What areas would you prioritize in terms of investing in the future of our nation through that appropriations process? Would it be education, infrastructure? What would you be looking to see us beef up or take away from? And how would you pay for some of those investments?
Well, Chase, I'm the product of a public school. And I went to a great public high school. I thought that's what public education was in this country until I got out in the world and I realized it's not necessarily what it is, but it's what it could be and should be. We have to even the playing field for all of our children. And fundamental to the promise of our country is that every kid, regardless of where they grow up, has an equal shot. And fundamental to that is great quality public education. We need to fund public schools. We need to work with underperforming schools. We need to work with public school teachers and empower them to make the best decisions on behalf of their students. And we've got a lot of work to do on that. Furthermore, our public university, as you know, is one of the most expensive in-state schools in the country. I mean, UNH is becoming almost inaccessible for working families in New Hampshire. And that's just missing the entire point. Of access to, a quality higher education. So we've got to find ways to help students have different pathways to school and make college affordable and work, to make sure our state school is affordable for working and middle-class families in New Hampshire.
And Maura, I can certainly relate to that. I went through law school, so I've got plenty of student loan debt to go with it. So what do you have any particular ideas right now that might help make college a little more affordable long-term? Different areas of investment and how you'd go about investing in the education system in our country?
Yeah, there's, I think there's a number of things that we can be focused on. First, we need to take a real hard look at the financing of student loans. I mean, people should not be profiting off of students going to school. When I went to go to college, I couldn't afford to go to a lot of the places I was looking at because my parents were worried I was going to come out of school with too much debt. And I talked to, a lot of the young people who've gotten involved with my campaign, and they're worried about, how much debt they're going to have coming out of UNH. So we've got to look at different financing options. Second, this administration has frozen the funding amount for Pell Grants. I think that's really concerning. And if you look at the full amount for a Pell Grant, it's a fraction of what UNH costs. So again, even at a fully funded amount, it's still only a fraction of what's covered. So I think we need to expand Pell Grants and different pathways to affording schools. Third, one thing I think we should take a look at is expanding national service opportunities for people who are willing to serve is a Pavlovsky scholarship to go to college because I was willing to serve and it was a way to afford an education. But the military isn't the right pathway for everybody. But I do think we can look at expanding the budget for AmeriCorps. For people that are willing to, go into teaching and medicine and other service professions as a pathway to be able to afford a higher education.
And Maura, let's also take a look at sort of what your role would be in Congress, and specifically when it comes to the budget process. It's pretty well known that Congress has a pretty low approval rating in terms of how the public views its effectiveness, and that especially comes down to a budget process that seems to have been broken for the last couple decades. Do you think the gridlock that we've seen in that process is a result of a lack of or failure of leadership? Or do you see that there are certain maybe reforms in that process that need to take place to help move it along?
Look, I think Washington's broken and we need new leadership across the board. What is happening right now is not working. And when you see these, you know, when you see the budget process and you see the, you know, the lack of Congress's ability to pass a budget, you know, I can tell you as someone who, you know, served, you know, was appointed by President Obama and served, you know, at a senior level at two agencies, at the VA and the Pentagon, that budget instability ultimately, it hurts our families. It hurts the good people that serve there because, you know, they're often sent home and not knowing when they're coming back and getting their next paycheck. So, you know, the budget instability is just bad all around, and Washington's broken, and we need new leaders that are going to go there and work together and put the country first and put the people that they're representing ahead of politics and get things done. Specifically, I would look to serve on the House Armed Services Committee, and I will make the case my first day in office to serve on that committee. Representative Carol Shea Porter has served on that committee, and she's done a really good job advocating for our shipyards and for PEAS as a member of the House Armed Services Committee. That is the committee that oversees, as you know, Chase, the Pentagon and defense spending, and has a very large role in passing the defense budget. And I'd be asking a lot of tough questions about, you know, why the Pentagon thinks it needs the funding that it does, and how it's, and moreover, how it is spending the resources that it has. And I'll tell you, you know, one of the first questions I'd ask is, you know, why when the Pentagon gets close to $700 billion a year, do we have a wait list for childcare currently at our shipyard? And, you know, that's unacceptable. And I'll tell you, having been on the other side of those conversations, you know, serving for President Obama at the Pentagon and working on our family policies, I'd be asking a lot of tough questions right now, and I know how to ask the questions, and I know the questions to ask.
And speaking of tough questions, Mauro, I've got one more for you before we have to go here. I appreciate you spending so much time with us. You mentioned earlier in the show how the tax code overhaul that increased budget deficits in the next 10 years, how that was, in essence, irresponsible and unnecessary. So my question for you is, looking at growing federal budget deficits, a growing national debt that's over $21 trillion now, would stabilizing that debt and working to reduce the deficits be a priority for you in Congress?
I mean, of course it will, because we have to make sure that we are handing our country. I mean, this is the country we're handing to our kids. And I don't want to hand, you know, our children and our grandkids the issues that our generation has been handed. I mean, that is part of the responsibility of our Congress. And that's not about, you know, being a Democrat. That's not about being a Republican. That's about being an American. And the job is, you know, I've taken an oath multiple times now to support and defend the Constitution. I did as a Marine. You know, when I served in Iraq, and I did, you know, when President Obama appointed me to serve in his administration at the VA and the Pentagon. So, you know, we've got to put the country first, and we have to work together, you know, as I said, find common ground, work with Democrats, work with Republicans to do what is in the best interest of our state and do what's in the best interest of our country. And that is how I will approach this job on behalf of our state.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and New Hampshire congressional candidate Maura Sullivan discuss her policy priorities and approach to tackling our nation's fiscal policy challenges. Thank you for joining the show, Maura.
Chase, thanks so much for having me. It was great to be on. Appreciate the discussion.
It's a great conversation. Thanks so much, Maura. Up next, I'll be joined by another New Hampshire congressional candidate, Terrence O'Rourke. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the program by New Hampshire congressional candidate Terrence O'Rourke. Terrence lives in Alton, New Hampshire with his wife and three kids. While in the Army, he earned the rank of captain and received a Bronze Star. Terrence has worked as an assistant U.S. attorney in Alabama, as an assistant county attorney in both Carroll and Rockingham counties here in New Hampshire. He has a JD from Tulane University and a bachelor's from Marquette. Terrence is currently the Rochester City Attorney and is running as a Democrat to represent the 1st Congressional District of New Hampshire. Thanks for joining the show, Terrence.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, we're happy to have you on the show, and I think before we dive into any fiscal policy discussion, I wanted to give you a chance to introduce yourself, maybe share why you're running for Congress to represent New Hampshire, and maybe what some of your top policy priorities might be.
Well, I think the best way to put why I'm running for Congress here in New Hampshire is because I think we're at sort of a perilous time in our history, both here in the state, in the United States, and around the world. And it's one of these situations where, you know, if good people don't step up to the plate, nothing's ever going to change. And the way I look at this race right now, it's an opportunity for our party to sort of redefine ourselves to what we used to be. Again, for me personally, as you mentioned, as a veteran, one of my top priorities is ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course the war surrounding that was in Syria, Somalia, and Niger. And then, of course, I want to rebuild our infrastructure, and I'm sure we're going to talk about this, rebuild our physical infrastructure and our human infrastructure as well. So that's what it's about for me, is, you know, essentially redefining the course for our party, and then redefining the course for America.
Well, we'll piggyback off your experience in the military, your desire to end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and talk a little bit about maybe military spending. There's basically two different types of spending in the budget: mandatory and discretionary. Discretionary has all of our domestic investment, and military defense spending, which is about 50-50, so about half that discretionary is spent on military. We're at about a 50-year low as a percentage of the economy in terms of how much we spend on the military. Certainly not nominal value. We're spending a lot more dollars-wise. But where do you see a need for investment, whether it's on the defense side, or do you want to see it reined in? Do you want to see some of that money shifted over to maybe some other domestic priorities? Where do you see that particular area of the budget in terms of what you'd like to see happen?
So I would definitely like to see the military budget drawn back. What we've seen now in the wars we fought in recent years is that the what we're spending our money on isn't what it's actually used in these wars. And again, I'm an Army guy, and I'm not here to pick on the United States Navy. But for example, we're spending all billions and billions of dollars on naval vessels that aren't worth anything when you're fighting in Iran, or you're fighting in Iraq, you're fighting in Afghanistan, or you're fighting essentially brown water wars, and we have a deep blue water Navy. You have a lot of assets in the Air Force, for example, that are long-range bombers, those sorts of things, when what we need is close air support for troops on the ground. And what you see is a lot of spending. It's very similar to what you saw in the 1980s when we were sort of fighting a Soviet Union, which was somewhat of an equal. We're still spending at those levels, but that's not who we're actually fighting in the battlefield. And what we see also is a lot of spending on stuff and not on people, right? And particularly, I think it was acute in the Army. Our barracks were terrible, right? Our soldiers, some of our soldiers were on food stamps because they couldn't afford their families, along with the salary wasn't enough. So I would like to see what we spend on those things, the stuff, drawn way back, and let's reform our military in terms of the wars we're fighting now. And also, let's actually care for the soldiers and sailors and invest more in the human side of it.
So let's talk a little bit more about the human investment side. Are you talking an increase in salaries for active members? Are you looking at investing more in the VA infrastructure in terms of aftercare when you get out of the military and healthcare? What are you specifically referring to?
So actually both. So for soldiers, I'm saying soldiers generally. I mean, it's for everybody. Again, I'm an Army guy. So what I can see from soldiers, yes, an increase in pay. You'd like to be able to have your soldiers be able to have a life on top of serving and being able to pay that will allow that to happen. I also like to see, while you're in the military, for example, as a field artilleryman, those are job skills that aren't particularly transferable. I mean, yes, leadership is transferable. Certainly logistics is transferable, but the actual act of shooting a cannon or shooting a rocket and shooting a missile is not particularly transferable in the civilian world. So what I'd like to see is an emphasis on, let's have some parallel structure going on when you're in the military, where you're learning some skills. So when you walk out of the military, you should be able to move into a civilian career that excites you as much as being in the military. And of course, once you get off of active duty, that's where the VA should step in and help there.
There's been a lot of talk in our country of equipping the next generation education-wise. I certainly think it makes sense to equip our members of the military and servicemen and women when they come back from active duty to jump right back into civilian life. So let's talk about more physical infrastructure investment. That's something you mentioned a little while ago. We're looking at, as soon as next year, the year after, the Congressional Budget Office is saying we'll have trillion-dollar deficits as a result of the current budget, sort of a structural deficit, as well as some recent legislation has made matters worse. How, in this environment of growing deficits, a growing national debt, do you propose investing more in, say, infrastructure or education? Or I know we talked a little bit about military and transitioning some of where we spend to other areas, but what about the rest of domestic investment?
So when you start talking about infrastructure, and I'll talk about physical infrastructure and what I consider human infrastructure, is that you get and I feel, a tremendous return on your investment. So you think about our physical infrastructure right now, our roads, our bridges, our airports, and our seaports. They're essentially at a grade of an F. You know, these engineering groups are out there, and they grade it. Like, you get a grade in school, and there may be some things that are a D or D plus, but overall we're an F. And you just drive around this country and in the state, and you see that a lot of this infrastructure is from the New Deal era or from the Eisenhower era, and you know, that is not, we're not equipped to move forward in the future. And also, when you're talking about infrastructure, you know, you're talking about telecommunications, internet, phone, all that stuff like that. Again, not up to the standard you're going to see there in Canada or in Western Europe. So when you invest in your infrastructure, you're actually investing in the economy, because there's no business out there that doesn't need roads. There's no business out there that doesn't need airports. There's a lot of business that needs seaports. Of course, everyone needs the communications infrastructure. We're way behind the power curve on this, and we need to invest in that. And again, it's a return on your investment. And secondly, when it comes to the human infrastructure, what I want to see there is investments in education and investments in healthcare. Let's start with healthcare. What I'd like to see, I think, the next logical step in this process of sort of providing universal, not-for-profit healthcare would be a Medicare for All system. But what I think, what I go a little bit further than some other candidates in this race, is I'd actually like to see a national health system like you see in Britain or in other countries in Europe. And if you look at the cost, yes, there would be obviously a short-term investment up front when you build a thing like that. But in the long term, it costs much less and you get better results. You see in countries like Italy, for example, who spends barely 9% of their GDP on healthcare, and their folks live 6 years longer on average than we do. And they have lower rates of cancer, lower rates of obesity, lower rates of diabetes, all these things that kind of go to your quality of life. Because I feel what they have there is a healthcare system instead of a sick care system. I don't want to go on a tangent here, but so let's also talk about education. And what I see right now, and being a particularly still prosecuting, is, you know, I see people who the system has failed them in a lot of ways, not just the education system, but sort of the values that we're placing on education. And when they leave high school, so high school, for example, they're not equipped to go into the job market. And what I like to see in education is when you walk out of high school, you should be able to get a job in a field if that's what you choose. You should be equipped to go on to college, because you think about it, and if you're a sports fan at all, you know that a lot of folks will end up going to a university to play sports, but then they get there and they're not equipped to actually be a student in college. And right. I'm using that as an example. There's others, you know, other people as well. So high school should mean something again in this country. And what I like to see there is, again, the federal government's role, as always, being the big dog out there, is to provide money and provide assets to make that happen. And I think another thing the federal government can do is start look at best practices. You know, something might be working in New Hampshire, and something might be working in Idaho, something might be working in Arizona. The federal government, that's that clearinghouse in the middle that can look at all these best practices and say, hey, Idaho, do you know New Hampshire's doing this? Or, hey, New Hampshire, you know Arizona's doing that? So, again, this is an investment in our human infrastructure, which, again, everyone knows there's a great return on that investment.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with New Hampshire congressional candidate Terrence O'Rourke, and we are discussing his policy priorities as well as his take on the nation's fiscal challenges. We covered a lot of ground in the last few minutes there, and so I want to break it down just a little bit. So we'll go back to infrastructure for a second here. The current administration is, and the House and Senate GOP have been talking about a big infrastructure plan, but are struggling to find ways to pay for it. So if you were to put forth a plan similar to what you mentioned, what are some of those first steps you would take to try and pay for it?
When you think about your budgetary policies and your tax policies, it's about what you feel that this society should be doing. And right now, it's in my opinion, you know, it's all geared towards the upper 1%. And what we need to do is reform our tax system. We need to reform the way we're bringing revenue into the government to be more reflective of our priorities. Again, you sort of alluded to the tax cuts that just got passed, which are exacerbating a lot of the problems that particularly your organization deals with. And it's not just the income tax we got to look at, you know, which I think there are additional brackets that need to be added above the top rate right now. We got to look at corporate taxation. Right now, it's a flat 21%. And that is, of course, before lawyers and accountants get involved, when sometimes it's basically
and we're
zero.
Both lawyers.
And we're both lawyers. You know, exactly. We know what the score is. And once lawyers and accountants get involved, these companies are paying zero or actually getting refunds. So what we need to do is these corporations should be taxed at similar progressive rates as earned income, and they got to cut these loopholes out. When you start looking at passive income, which of course top rate is 20%, and we don't get there till around, I believe, $450,000 in a year. That's something that I first sort of learned about in college. You know, of course, I didn't have any passive income, and I was in a poli sci class.
I don't know if many in college have passive income. We're still trying to dig our way out of debt.
Exactly, and I thought, wow, this is totally unfair how passive income is taxed at the top level at half of what earned income is. So what I'd like to see is those rates, again, match up with what is being done in terms of earned income. So when you start having more revenue coming in, right, so that's one side of budgetary policy. And then the other side is how you're going to spend it. We touched on the military budget earlier. We want to see that drawn way, way back, scaled back on what we're spending, and start reprioritizing how we're going to spend our money. So infrastructure is something that, unless you're sort of a dead-ender who's not going to vote for any government spending, every congressperson, every senator has roads, bridges, airports, seaports in their district. So it not only brings immediate sort of economic impact when you're building these things, in the long term, again, I have a hard time putting my business in your district if the roads are terrible, if the bridges are terrible, if I can't get internet, if I can't get, you know, working phone lines. Again, it's an investment, and we know that those dollars come back to the government, come back to the localities they're in.
And it sounds like one of the other points you mentioned earlier was education and making investments there. I'm assuming you'd have a similar answer. The money for that would come from reform in the tax code.
Absolutely. Yep.
So let's skip right then to the big topic, and that's healthcare.
Yeah.
You put a lot on the table there,
yes.
Discussing working toward a Medicare for All type program,
yes.
Or maybe even ultimately a national mm-hmm. universal mm-hmm. Healthcare program like other nations. And you mentioned the short-term investment. I would argue that it's maybe a little more substantial than just a little investment. Mm-hmm. I've seen figures as high as $15 trillion mm-hmm. in the first 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that all comes back to how much savings you can get within the system.
Yep.
You know, whether it's a purely payroll tax-based system or a payroll tax and premium-based system like Medicare currently is. So my question, after all that long intro, is if, as the Medicare trustees are currently saying, Medicare is walking towards insolvency, mm-hmm. its trust fund is depleting, it's heavily supplemented by general tax revenue, mm-hmm. how would you reform the existing system so that you would be able to maybe eventually expand it?
Right. So I don't like to defer to other people, but, you know, there are experts on these issues. And if you go to Senator Sanders' website and his proposal for Medicare for All, he lays out a very detailed plan on how to fund it. And I frankly think there's a lot of ways to skin this cat, but he's obviously put a lot of thought into this. And you're right, it is going to be involved. What his plan would be is, I think it's 6.2% on progressive income on the employer side, 2.2% on the earners, again, on the income side of the house, and then the reforms to the tax system, which we talked about earlier. And so when you do that, it adds up along with the savings. And what we have right now in terms of our insurance system is there's a profit built in for the insurance companies, right? But that's not created wealth. That's not value added. That is just money being taken out of providing health care for people and being put into the pockets of the insurance companies. When you take that away, there's savings there and there's less administrative overrun, all that. So I understand what you're saying, and I understand that it's going to cost money. But at the same time, in the long run in America, we live in a consumer society where we think of things right immediately. But we got to think about the health of our country going in the next 100 years, 200 years, and this is the only system that actually makes any sense.
We can certainly be very short-sighted in our country, especially when it comes to being a member of Congress and
yep.
looking at the next election. You know, as an organization, we advocate for a long-term view, so I can appreciate the perspective you're sharing. I think it might be more than just a policy issue. I think we would need a significant shift in how our country views healthcare,
mm-hmm.
Both from a government perspective and an individual perspective. So say you're in Congress. How would you work with members of your current party and the opposing party to find some bipartisan consensus on the next best step for healthcare?
So just let me start with working with Republicans first. People, I think, don't maybe get, because, you know, we're Americans and we live in that prism, but in these other countries, there's a perception, particularly on the other side, that, you know, sort of everyone in France is a liberal. Well, no, that's not true, right? Not in England and France and Germany and these countries, they have the political spectrum from extremely far right to extremely far left and all things in between. But what they all have agreement on is the national health system. And when you think about it, promoting businesses here, what is the number one cost driver to businesses in America?
probably healthcare.
Healthcare, right. And particularly small businesses, it's healthcare. And as you mentioned earlier, we're both lawyers. And in your life, you know, you sort of think, boy, I should go in my own practice. Or you have a friend or a couple friends and you're in a similar area of law. And you're like, we should open a law firm. And the first thing you think of when you start, actually, when you get serious about it, you start looking at them, it's like, wow. How are we going to provide health insurance for us, our families, and for our employees?
And then also malpractice insurance.
And then malpractice insurance, which as a government lawyer, you don't ever have to worry about. And then so you start looking at that, and from our Republican friends on a business-friendly point of view, it makes sense, right? Because we think about the cost of business providing not just health insurance to their current employees, but to legacy folks, which you saw with our auto industry. It makes them not competitive with the people they're competing against in Japan and in Germany and England and in Italy. So it makes sense from an economic point of view. And then for like the Democratic Party, you appeal to them that our healthcare system right now is a sick care system. We go to the doctor when we're sick. Men in particular are bad at this. We go when we're really sick. So what I like to see in a national health system is we actually have a healthcare where we're looking at from prenatal all the way to natural death is nutrition, exercise, taking care of the one and only, you know, body you're ever going to have for this one and only life you're ever going to have. And it makes sense from a point of view as a single payer, whether that's, again, Medicare for All or National Health System. I don't want you coming in when it's going to cost us $50,000 or $60,000. I'd rather you're coming in every year, every quarter, all along and doing the right thing. So I never hit that $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $400,000 medical issue. So, again, when we have a healthcare system instead of a sick care system, it's going to keep prices down, cost down, and actually increase the overall, not only length of your life, but the quality of that life.
And unfortunately, we're running short on time, and I still have like three or four topics I still want to discuss, which we won't get to. But one big one, and it's largely driven by demographics, and its own trustees have also said it's running towards insolvency, and that's Social Security. Yep. From your perspective, do you think the system needs reform? And if it needs reform, what kind of reform? Are we at a juxtaposition where we might have to change it for future generations? Or is this something that you can tweak and make it sustainable long term without any major overhaul?
So let me just talk about how we fund Social Security before we start talking about some of the reforms to it. So right now it's capped. The income that is susceptible to Social Security taxation, I believe it's 127. And the last time they sort of looked at this in a hard way was in 1983. And put in perspective for people listening, Ronald Reagan was president and Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House. So it's been a long time. And when they came up with that, the system, the amount of money being made above the cap as a percentage of the total income was much smaller than it is now. And the cap has gone up over time. I think it was around 83,000 then. We say we're around 120 something now. But as the income pie, of course, in America has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, the amount of that pie that's over that cap is greater than it's ever been before. So what I would like to see is just eliminate the cap altogether and make all earned income susceptible to Social Security taxation. And another thing in terms of funding is I think I'd like to see unearned income over 450 susceptible to a 6% Social Security tax as well. So I think at that point you've really solved the fiscal side of the solvency issue. However, in terms of what you're talking about, systematic reform, as someone who has prosecuted Social Security fraud, and abuse, there is a ton of it in the system. And I don't want to be, someone out here causing a lot of panic or anything, but it's one of these situations where there's so many people applying for it and so few people administering it that you end up becoming, you chasing them down, right, when you find out later on. So there's all this money being pulled out of the system by people who don't deserve it or people who are essentially defrauding the system. So we really need to take a hard look at how we're doing this, particularly with SSDI. There's a cottage industry in a lot of, there are lawyers out there, and again, since we're lawyers, we can talk about this, who entire practices, how I'm going to get you on SSDI, how I'm going to rework this supposed injury you've had. So again, I believe in the social safety net. It's something we have to have. But at the same time, if people continue to defraud and continue to take advantage of it, it's going to lead people to want to get rid of it, and it's not going to be there for people who need it.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and New Hampshire congressional candidate Terrence O'Rourke discuss his policy priorities and approach to tackling our nation's fiscal policy challenges. Thanks for being on the show, Terrence.
Thank you so much.
Next week, I'll be joined on the show by congressional candidate Chris Pappas. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.